part of this series, and to isomorphism rigidity. Of algebraic set D actions. On connected groups. So let me start with an example of two matrices, A and B, on the three torus, which commute and which therefore define an algebraic Z-squared action. And the matrix B is 1, 2, minus 1, minus 1, minus 2, 2, 2, 5, minus 2. It's not terribly difficult to find two such matrices. Well, it's not difficult to find two commuting matrices. But there is one condition which is equivalent to mixing in this case, that A to the M, B to the N is equal to 1 if and only if M equal N equals 0. This is equivalent to mixing. And then we have a second action. Yes, I hope they are. Yeah. This is I'm sorry, I've picked the wrong matrices. I have to apologize. Can we rewind the tape? So it's 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 2, minus 1, minus 1, minus 4, minus 2. And the matrix B is 1, 2, minus 1. Yeah, that the matrix B is correct. Now, if you take the matrix V, which is not of determinant 1, and it's of the form 2, minus 2, minus 1, 0, minus 3, 0, and 1, minus 4, and minus 2, then the matrices A prime equal to V inverse AV, and B prime equal to V inverse BV, are again integer matrices. The matrix V does not have determinant 1, so it's not automatic that these be integer matrices, and they are given by 2 minus 4 minus 1, 1 minus 4 minus 1, 1 minus 5 minus 1, and the B prime is nice. It's 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, and minus 1, 6, minus 3. So the matrices, or the Z-squared action generated by A and B, alpha is the Z-squared action generated by these two matrices, and alpha prime is the Z-squared action generated by these two matrices, they're very closely related. They are, in fact, one of them is, each one is a finite to one factor of the other. And the question is whether they are measurably conjugate. It's clear that A and A prime are measurably conjugate because they have the same eigenvalues. Therefore, they have the same entropy. They are ergodic. Therefore, they are Bernoulli. And Bernoulli automorphisms with the same entropy are measurably conjugate. You can even choose a nice conjugacy between them, which is almost topological. This means that you remove a relatively small set from the three torus and the conjugacy between these two matrices is then a homeomorphism on what's left. But once again, as we saw, or at least as I claimed yesterday, for some zero-dimensional examples, the fact that each element in this action is nicely conjugate to the corresponding element in this action does not imply that the two actions are conjugate in any way, measurably conjugate. So let me describe some of the ideas which lead to resolving this question, in this case to proving that these two actions are not measurably conjugate. It started off with I've given already the general recipe. If these actions, so the recipe or the idea of resolving this question is to assume if there exists a conjugacy, this is a measurable conjugacy, phi, which is a map from the three torus to the three torus, with phi alpha n equal to alpha prime n phi for all n, just in case it's not already obvious, but alpha n1, n2 is simply a to the n1, b to the n2, and the same thing with alpha prime. So if there exists a measurable conjugacy, then the graph of phi, so this is the set of all x, phi of x, with x in the three torus, this is a subset in the six torus, which is alpha cross alpha prime invariant. That's because phi is a conjugacy. And the graph, this graph carries an alpha cross alpha prime invariant measure, which projects to the Hahn measure on each of the two coordinates. To lambda, so this is Lebesgue measure, on each three torus. So the picture is this. Here we have T3. Here we also have T3. Then here is, well, it should be a graph, but what I'm drawing is not one. Here is gamma of phi. And you can put on this set a measure which projects the Lebesgue measure here and projects the Lebesgue measure here. Suppose you had a result of the following form. Any measure with the right properties, what do we know about this measure? This measure is mixing. Let's give this measure a name, mu. Mu is mixing. Because the projection onto either of these two sides is one-to-one. Therefore, the action alpha cross alpha prime on the measure mu is measurably conjugate, in fact it's very nicely conjugate, to the original action alpha with on Lebesgue measure. Now that one is mixing, so alpha cross alpha prime is mixing with respect to the measure mu, which is what I just claimed. Now suppose you had a result that any such measure is Hahn measure, or is the Hahn measure on some coset of an invariant subgroup. In fact, this coset also has to be invariant. So it's an invariant coset of an invariant subgroup. Then you'd be done. Because if this measure, which is sitting on this graph, so I'll write down the statement, mu is Hahn measure, is a translate. Of the Hahn measure of some invariant subgroup, and that implies that phi is affine. This, of course, is something one has to prove, and we'll be talking about various generations of this result in what follows. So, assuming that there is such a measurable conjugacy, we find once again, as we did yesterday, that the map phi is in fact affine. But if the map is affine, then these two matrices are in fact algebraically conjugate to the corresponding matrices down here. But they are not, because it's actually easy to see that they are not. You look at this matrix, that's a companion matrix. Companion matrix of its characteristic polynomial. So this says that Z3 is generated by the orbit of a single element in Z3 under this matrix. Companion matrices. This is what characterizes companion matrices. There exists a vector M such that M, B prime M, and B prime squared M generates Z cubed. That's exactly what companion matrices are. Let me move this. But one can check that there is no such matrix for, no such M in Z3 for this matrix, so that they cannot be algebraically conjugate, so the whole actions cannot be conjugate. So how does one prove that measures, invariant measures, which are perhaps sufficiently nice, are in fact Hahn measures of subgroups, or at least translates of such measures? This question is much older than this rigidity result. And it started off with a result by Fürstenberg, which I have already mentioned, on invariant sets for two group endomorphisms, namely multiplication by 2 and multiplication by 3. So if time doesn't run out before then, I'll try and make the path from Fürstenberg's result about invariant sets. This was 1967. He was interested in the invariant sets for times 2 and times 3 on R mod Z. Since one should occasionally prove something, and since this proof is so nice, this is a polished version of the proof, which is due to Bushenitsyn. Let me try and prove the result that any infinite closed invariant set is equal to R mod Z, which we have been calling T all the time. So how do you prove this? You look at the set capital S, consisting of all integers of the form 2 to the K, 3 to the L, with K and L greater than or equal to 0. That's a subset of the natural numbers. And you arrange the terms in increasing order. So this, let's call this T1 less than T2, and so on. So T1 is 1, the next term is probably 2, then comes 3, then comes 4, and so on. So you look at this sequence which you get, containing all numbers which can be written as products of powers of 2 and 3. Then the claim is that the limit of tk divided by tk minus 1 is equal to 1. So the gaps between successive terms become relatively small, at least small in comparison to the size of the terms. Well, that's not so hard. The proof, we fix an epsilon greater than naught, and then we can find K1 and L1 such that zero is less than L1 times log 2 divided by log 3. We're just exploiting the fact that log 2 over log 3 is irrational. Minus K1 is less than logarithm of 1 plus epsilon divided by log 3. That's certainly possible, because the multiples of this irrational number modulo integers is dense. Similarly, we can find K2 and L2 such that, well, now let me exponentiate this first. So this says that 1 is less than 2 to the L1 times 3 to the minus K1, and this is less than 1 plus epsilon. Have I done the calculation correctly? Yes. And similarly, we can find K2 and L2 such that 1 is less than 2 to the minus K2 times 3 to the L2 less than 1 plus epsilon. So now if Tj is greater than 2 to the K2, 3 to the sort of 2 to 3 to the K1, then T to the J is divisible either by 2 to the K2 or by 3 to the L 3 to the K1. Tj is divisible by either 2 to the K2 or by 3 to the K1. So Tj plus 1, that's the next term in the sequence we have defined here. So this will be less than or equal to Tj times 2 to the L1 times 3 to the minus K1. So this is assuming that Tj is divisible by 3 to the K1. Then this is an element of S. Or in the other case, T to the J plus 1 is less than or equal to Tj times 2 to the times 3 to the L2, 2 to the minus K2, which is again in S. And this is only by a factor of 1 plus epsilon greater than Tj. Okay? So we found these terms, which are close to 1, and the Tj plus 1 is less than or equal to Tj times one of these terms. One of them is going to work. And therefore, the Tj plus 1 is going to be at most 1 plus epsilon times Tj. This depended only on Tj being large enough. Therefore, we see that the limit of these ratios is equal to 1. So the sequence S, this set S, has this property, and this property is called non-lacunarity. So S is non-lacunary. That's just a definition. It's any subset of the natural numbers which, when you order it linearly, has the property that the ratio of successive terms tends to 1. If S is non-lacunary, then S to the M is non-lacunary. So this is just the set of all T to the M with M in S. This is also non-lacunary. For any M greater than or equal to 1. You just raise these ratios to the M's power and they still tend to 1. Thank you. Right. So, okay. Now, suppose we have a lacunary set. We are only using the lacunarity of S now and not its special nature. And suppose we have a set B in T, which is closed and invariant under S. So what this means is that if X lies in B and T lies in S, then Tx lies in B. If this set is infinite, then it's going to have a limit point. If 0 is a limit point of B, then it's clear that B is everything, because we can multiply points close to 0 by elements of S, by ratios of elements which are close to 1, so we get a chain of points. Each of them differs from the previous one only by a multiple of 1 plus epsilon, and they will lie, if the epsilon is chosen nicely, they will lie epsilon prime dense in the unit interval. Okay? So if we have a limit point of B, then we can conclude that B is epsilon dense in the unit interval in T for every epsilon greater than naught, and that of course means that B is the whole interval. As I said, the idea is that there must be points which are very close to 0. You multiply them by successive ratios of elements in S which are close to 1, and you get that an epsilon dense set. What happens if you have a rational limit point? If A over B is a limit point of B, what do we do then? Then we choose an M with 2 to the M equal to 1 mod B and 3 to the M equal to 1 mod B. I should make point out one thing. If A over B is a rational number, which is a limit point of B, then we can assume without loss of generality that B has no, does not, that 2 and neither 2 nor 3 divide B. Because we can multiply A over B by any occurrence, any power of 2, to remove any power of 2 in the denominator. And similarly, we can multiply by any power of 3 to remove any power of 3 in the denominator and get another rational limit point, which now has no power of 2, no factor of 2 or 3 in the denominator. And that's still a limit point, because the set is invariant and limit points are mapped to limit points. So without loss of generality, we have assumed that 2b is equal to 1, 3b is equal to 1, and I guess we might as well assume that A and B have no common factors. Okay, so now we take B minus A over B, this set. That now has 0 as a limit point. And it's invariant under S to the M. That's how we have chosen the M. The A over B is fixed under under 2 to the M and 3 to the M. So this is S to the M invariant and has 0 as a limit point. So by the first part, we know that B is everything. So the last step is what is to decide what to do if there is no rational limit point in B. So B is infinite. Otherwise, if B were finite, then every point in B would have to be rational. After all, the set B is invariant under multiplication by 2 and by 3. And if there are only finitely many choices, then this thing must start cycling under multiplication by 2, which means that any point you start off with must be rational. So B is infinite, and we said B equal to B naught. This contains a set B1, which is about to be... We should fix some numbers. We fix epsilon greater than naught, and R greater than 3, and an M greater than or equal to 1, such that 1 over R is less than epsilon, and 2 to the M equal to 3 to the M equal to 1 mod R. So we start with epsilon, then we choose the R sufficiently large, and then we choose the M to satisfy this condition. Now we define sets B1 up to BR minus 1. And each BK plus 1 is the set of all X in BK with the property that X plus 1 over R is also in BK. This set is obviously closed because inductively the B is closed, and then you see that all the later ones must be closed. And it is invariant under S to the M. That's because we have chosen the M not to do anything to the 1, so that 2 to the M and 3 to the M send 1 over R to itself. So the B naught is infinite, right? Because it's just B. Now I claim that if BK, by induction, if BK is infinite, then BK plus 1 is infinite. Well, put CK equal to BK minus BK, the set of all differences of elements in BK, then since BK is infinite, this must contain 0 as a limit point. The BK will have some limit point, but by subtracting this limit point from itself, you find that 0 is a limit point. So CK is a set which has 0 as a limit point and which is invariant under S to the M. So this is, it has 0 is a limit point. And by the very first part up there, we see that CK is everything. So in particular, 1 over R lies in CK. But this says that there is an element in BK which is still in BK when you add 1 over R to it. Okay? So if 1 over R lies in CK, it means that BK plus 1 is non-empty. So there are points in BK, say X and Y, such that X minus Y is equal to 1 over R, but that's just saying that Y plus 1 over R is again in BK. So this says that BK plus 1 is non-empty. But BK plus 1 cannot, it's a subset of B naught, of B, and therefore it cannot contain any rational points. So BK plus 1, because it's non-empty and contains at least one irrational point, it must be infinite. BK plus 1 is infinite because it has no rational point. So all these sets are infinite. So the last set is infinite. BR minus 1 is infinite. You still with me? It's infinite, but all we need is that it's non-empty. So now we have a point in, this should be a minus one here. So now we have found a point X in B naught such that x plus 1 over r lies in b naught, x plus 2 over r lies in b naught, and so on. X plus r minus 1 over r lies in b naught. We have found a 1 over r net in our set B. So B contains a 1 over r, and because 1 over r is less than epsilon, so it's an epsilon net, and it's, yeah. This is true for every epsilon, so, and B is closed, so B is everything. So this is the proof that any set which is invariant under multiplication by 2 and by 3, and which is infinite, which is the same thing as saying that it does not consist only of finitely many rational points, that any such set must be everything. But this, yeah, so what did the proof actually depend on? The proof depended only on the non-lacunarity of S. And the non-lacunarity of S is in turn a consequence of the fact that there are powers of 2 and powers of 3 which cancel almost exactly. So multiplication by 2 and multiplication by 3, these are both expanding maps. If you make them invertible in a way which I have indicated at one stage earlier in the lectures, you get something which is not expanding, but which is expansive. Points cannot stay close to zero, either under forward or under backward iteration of these maps. They must get away from zero at some stage. So the action multiplication by 2 and by 3 is expansive, but it nevertheless contains elements which change distances by almost nothing. That was the non-lacunarity of S. So you get, because we have two maps, both of which expand or contract, but we have two independent ones, like log 2 and log 3, we are using here the rational independence of log 2 and log 3, they must cancel at least in some asymptotic sense. There must be a way of going to infinity in Z squared such that multiplication by the appropriate powers of 2 times the appropriate powers of 3 tends to 1. And this is also at the root of the proof that any invariant measure, in this particular case, any invariant measure under multiplication by 2 and by 3 with an additional hypothesis is equal to Lebesgue measure. Well, since it's only a one-line proof due to Horst, I'll present that proof, but I'll state the theorem first of all. The theorem is due to Dan Rudolph, and that was the first result on measures of such systems. You take a measure mu on R mod Z, be a probability measure, which is ergodic and invariant under times 2 and times 3. So invariance is clear, I've described that. It means that the pre-image of a set under multiplication by 2 has the same measure as before. Ergodic means that there are no sets of measure other than 0 or 1 which are invariant under both times 2 and times 3. If mu is not equal to Lebesgue measure, then times 2 and times 3 are invertible with respect to this measure mu. Or they have zero entropy. Both have zero entropy. I'm not going to, I'm sure many of you, most of you know what entropy is. The equivalence of this means that a measure has zero entropy if and only if, when you take a point x and you send it to 2x, the target y equal to 2x has not only x as a predecessor, but also x plus 1/2. So under multiplication by 2, every point has 2 predecessors. It doesn't mean that the measure has to see them both. As far as the measure is concerned, that may be concentrated on an invariant set in which x has only one predecessor. And that's precisely what zero entropy for the map x goes to 2x means. So what we have to prove, if we want to prove this result for multiplication by 2, that there is some set of measure 1 which has the property that amongst the 2 possible predecessors of any point in it, only one of them lies in this set. And the same thing with times 3, there you have a choice of 3 predecessors and you want to be able to pick only one of them. Let me give you a proof, which is a clever joke, I think. I don't think that this is an offense to Bernard Horst. He proves this result in practically one line. Rudolf's proof is considerably more than a line, and all subsequent simplifications or modifications of this proof are also considerably longer than one line. But Horst gives an ad hoc proof under the assumption that multiplication by 3 is already ergodic, not the joint action, but multiplication by 3. This is just to indicate how much more difficult the problem becomes if you don't assume ergodicity of the measure under a particular map in this action. So, if mu is ergodic under times 3, so we want to prove that if you know the image of a point x under 2, under times 2, then x is the only pre-image of that second value modulo the measure mu. So how do we do that? We take this measure mu and we look at its Fourier transform, mu hat of k. So mu is the invariant measure. Well, the measure mu is Lebesgue measure if and only if this is zero for every k other than zero. So if mu is not Lebesgue, then mu hat of k is not equal to zero for some non-zero k. I'm now going to assume without loss of generality that this k is equal to 1. The reason why we can do this is if, let's say, mu hat of 5 is equal to 0, is not equal to 0, then we look at the 5 to 1 covering map of the circle to itself. That sends the measure mu to a new measure on the circle, which is again invariant under times 2 and times 3, and which now has mu hat, or nu is the new measure, mu hat of 1 is the old mu hat of k, or 5 in this case. So, without loss of generality, the k is equal to 1. You could get worried a little bit about uniqueness of the predecessors under this map, but that's not a major point. I'll skip over that. So let's look at an expression. We take a point x in t, and we look at an expression which only depends on 2x. So let's look at e to the 4 pi I times x plus 3x plus and so on, 3 to the n minus 1 x. This depends only on 2x, right? Because we have a 4 here, not a 2. Now this is equal to e to the 2 pi I times 3 to the mx, 3 to the nx minus 1. Geometric series here. You see 3 to the nx minus 1 over 2, and I've taken the 2 out to reduce the 4 to 2. So if we now take 1 over capital N, sum m little n equal to 1 to capital N of e to the 2 pi I, 3 to the m x minus 1. This all depends on 2x. We just vary the n now, the n which appeared here, and take an average. Okay? I'm doing this, I'm using this identity for n equal to 1, n equal to 2, and so on. Yes? Oh, yes, minus x. Sorry. Thank you. It's always nice to see that somebody's still awake. So now we use the fact that multiplication by 3 is ergodic. What does this converge to? This converges to mu hat of 1 times e to the minus 2 pi I x. I would now have noticed that the x is missing here. But this is non-zero. So we were able to calculate e to the 2 pi I x, in other words, x itself, from 2x. So the predecessor, namely the x, is uniquely determined by the 2x. Of course, there is a null set involved because we are using the ergodic theorem, that, which is a convergence almost everywhere. That's precisely what we wanted. I mean, there is some null set about which we want to exclude, and outside this null set, we have the possibility of determining x from knowing 2x. So this says that 2 is invertible with respect to this measure. Now, this proof is, as I said, very smart, but unfortunately it really only works for times 2 and times 3, and it makes this additional assumption that times 3 is ergodic. Now, Rudolf spent considerable effort on avoiding this assumption on multiplication by 3, but for our purposes, it's actually not so disastrous to assume ergodicity under an individual element of the action, because if you remember what we were trying to do, the measure which we had located on the graph of the conjugacy between the two actions alpha and alpha prime, say, that was actually mixing. And mixing certainly implies that every element of the action is ergodic. So this, when there are strong aesthetic objections to making this assumption, but for what we are actually trying to do with it, it's no disaster. But what is a disaster is that we are using an arithmetical accident involving multiplication by 2 and multiplication by 3 here. So let's assume that alpha is an irreducible algebraic Z. No, let's stick to commuting plural automorphisms. Well, let me give you the general definition and then we'll restrict again. Zd action on a compact connected abelian group X. The two commuting matrices which we started off with are an example of this. I should tell you what irreducible means. It means that every closed alpha invariant subgroup Y in X, Y not in X and not equal to X, is finite. So this is what irreducible means. Then we want to know, then here's a theorem, which I'm stating in a form which is stronger than it was originally proved in, just as Host's result makes stronger assumptions about ergodicity. This theorem is due to Kartok and Spatier. If mu is a mixing alpha invariant measure on X, which is not equal to Haar measure, then the entropy with respect to mu of any automorphism alpha to the M is equal to 0 for any M in Zd. So the only way you could have some positive entropy coming in is if you actually have Haar measure, Lebesgue measure. This is less general than their result because they don't assume mixing. It's more general than the result which they had stated in their paper. They were dealing with commuting toral automorphisms. This here includes a system like times 2 and times 3 made invertible. That's not on a torus anymore. It's one of these things you talk about occasionally. It's a line cross a Cantor set. So it's not connected, not locally connected. I mean, it is connected. But so there are some more general possibilities here. Now, this result also works for Cartesian products of such actions, for alpha, for an action of the form alpha cross beta, where alpha and beta are irreducible. And that's the form we need, because remember what we were trying to show, that the isomorphism, the conjugacy between these two actions, that's a subset on the Cartesian product of the two groups on which alpha and beta operate, that this graph carries an invariant measure, which is a translate of the Haar measure of a subgroup, and therefore this map phi was affine. As I said, this is not the most general version of the result. You can extend it in a number of directions, but you cannot extend it beyond the situation where each individual element of the action has finite entropy. So irreducibility is, think of it without, I got 4 minutes, I will not explain too much about the notion of irreducibility, but it means that you're on a finite dimensional torus or solenoid, and that the action, the ZD action, looks pretty much like an action by commuting toral automorphisms. There is a whole spectrum of zero entropy algebraic ZD actions on connected groups, which sort of are bigger. So suppose you have a Z3 action, alpha. Then this Z3 action has a certain rank, which I'm now going to define. You call it rank 1 if the individual elements of the action have finite entropy. You call it rank 2 if the Z-squared actions have finite entropy and the individual automorphisms have infinite entropy. And it has rank 3, top rank, if the whole Z-cubed action has positive entropy. So let's assume that the Z-squared sub-actions have positive finite entropy. That's an assumption. I'm in a little bit of a hurry, so I'm not writing down enough here. So we have a Z-cubed action alpha. The Z-squared sub-actions have finite entropy, so the Z-cubed action has zero entropy. The Z-actions have infinite entropy because these have positive entropy. If you take two such actions, you would again expect that any measurable conjugacy between them is algebraic. But at present, there are no methods to cope with this problem. Even if you assume that this action alpha is one of these actions given by an appropriate prime ideal. So these are the building blocks of more general actions. But even in these special cases, nothing is known about measurable rigidity, this isomorphism rigidity. Just incidentally, these irreducible actions, they are precisely actions of this form, where the prime ideal P is maximal in the following sense. It's the set of all functions in RD which vanish at some point, some single point. This point for times 2 and times 3 happens to be the point 2,3 in C squared. Okay? And in general, it would be it has something to do with the this point has something to do with the eigenvalues of the commuting matrices if you are on a finite dimensional torus. So yesterday, Bhattacharya's result, which I mentioned, was actually a method of closing this gap. In yesterday's result about isomorphism rigidity, there was also an earlier version of this result in the irreducible case, which was due to Bruce Kitchens and myself. But that was a result, we proved it, but from the proof it was kind of apparent to us that it was the wrong proof. And then Bhattacharya's method opened up the way to deal with these intermediate rank actions. But that, at present, only works for actions on zero-dimensional groups. In the connected case, there are no nice approaches, not even really nice conjectures, which will show the way towards isomorphism rigidity here. So I think I better stop now. I have maybe 1 minute left or so. Well, thank you for your patience. And lecture 5, if it ever happens, will happen in 2003.
Any questions? What are the non-expansive directions for times 2 and times 3?
There are three of them.
Okay.
One of them is log 2 over log 3. One is times 2. But you see the non-expansiveness on the triadic integers, which you come in when you make times 3 invertible. So the space is instructive and deceptive at the same time. If you try and make times 2 and times 3 invertible, then you end up with the following space. So originally you start with R mod Z. If you make it invertible, you get R cross the dyadic integers cross the triadic integers modulo Z, where Z is diagonally embedded in this Cartesian product. And multiplication by 2, say, is just multiplying by 2 in each of these three factors simultaneously. So what happens? Here it expands by a factor of 2. Here it contracts by a factor of 2, because if you multiply by a dyadic integer by 2, the leading digit becomes 0, the whole thing gets smaller by a factor of 2. Here it's an isometry. So times 2 is not expansive, because if you take a point whose first two components are 0, then nothing expands or contracts in this point, and here it just rotates around. Times 3 is non-expansive for the same reason, except now the non-expansiveness happens here. And if you multiply by a power of something like 2 to the k, 3 to the l, where k over l is equal to log 2 over log 3, or the other way around, I can't work it out at the moment, then it's again non-expansive, because it's non-expansive in this direction here. So there are three possible constraints. One is that there is no power of 3 involved. One is that there is no power of 2 involved. And the third one is that the powers of 2 and 3 cancel out exactly. But anything else is expansive. So the Weyl chamber picture would be equal to something like this. Maybe not quite at that angle.
Yeah? So within the chambers you have the hyperbolic.
In each of these chambers you
center.
Right. In each of these chambers.